Okay, so second lecture of this course. I'm trying to record this again. Maybe now it works. And yeah, today we will be discussing ICP-OS analysis in practice. So some things about what are the sample backgrounds we can use with ICP-OS, limits of detection and quantification, how to determine these. Then calibration and solution preparations, some thoughts about the interferences present and how to correct these. Next week we will be discussing, so what are the technical, how does the ICP actually work? So ICP-OS, so how is it working? So this week we will be focusing on these topics now. Yeah, so I will turn this. Maybe it will catch me talking better. The sample matrices that we can use with ICP-OS. So the most important thing, of course, would be that the analytes should remain in solution and preferably for longer periods of time. So we would like the analytes to be in solution, let's say, for a few months at least. So that's a good starting point. In some cases, it may be that we need to analyze the samples quite soon. So if there are very low concentrations and the stability is a little bit not so good, we need to analyze them straight away. But usually we like to do it that they are stable for longer periods of time. So we will add some acid into the sample to get them into a stable state. Nitric acid is the most common used acid in the ICP-OS and in ICP-MS. So also, most elements are stable in nitric acid because they form soluble nitrates. Some elements are unstable here. I mentioned them here. So some of these will require different chemicals to stay in solutions. Silicon, for example, will require fluoride or some other chemicals, germanium, zirconium, for instance. They also like to have fluoride in the solution to be stable. Then we have these, we have some platinum group elements here, iridium, platinum, gold. I think these are refractory elements to, I'm finding the term, ruthenium, rhodium, and so on. So refractory elements here, which also require some other background than nitric acid. But in most cases, we are using nitric acid because there is absence of chemical and spectral interferences. So the nitric acid itself doesn't cause us any problems in the analysis. It's also frequently used in digestion of solid samples. It's oxidizing acid. So it's very handy when we are dealing with solid samples that we need to pre-treat to get them into soluble state, into solutions. Then hydrochloric acid is the next most common acid. All elements except for silver are stable in hydrochloric acid. But the reason that we don't use hydrochloric acid so often is because it's volatile and corrosive to the electronics of the instruments. So that's why we tend to avoid it. But in some cases, we cannot help it. So for at least for the platinum group elements, we need to have HCl to get them to stay in solution. For the silver, I have to mention, so silver is not stable in very low concentrations of HCl, but if you have high concentration of hydrochloric acid is in most cases stable. So silver is a little bit tricky element. So if you have it in nitric acid media, and if you have some little contamination of hydrochloric acid, you would get silver chloride precipitating from the solution. So you need to think about very carefully when you analyze silver, that if you're working in nitric acid media, not to introduce any chloride into the sample, because it will precipitate, and then you will get erroneous results. So we have done it in most cases that we have put it into aqua regia, quite high aqua regia concentration, 20% aqua regia, and then it has been okay. So there has been no, like, there is no fear that we are introducing a small amount of chloride in this case, because we are working in a high chloride media. Yeah. Then some other sample matrices, water at pH 7. Sometimes we need to analyze maybe in water background, but we need to analyze them quite soon because there is possible biological growth problems with this. So if you have water at pH 7, analyze soon as possible. And it's only suitable for some metals which do not easily precipitate from solution, such as alkali metals, halogens, boron, carbon, nitrogen, and so on. So it's not very often used, but it can be used. Hydrofluoric acid. This is tricky one. For some elements, we will require hydrofluoric acid. So silicon, for example, maybe titanium in some cases. And I mentioned the elements that are stable in HF here, but not all of these will require HF, so keep that in mind. It requires a dedicated sample introduction system because hydrofluoric acid corrodes glass, and usually we are working with a glass sample introduction system, so we will need to change the sample introduction system. So we have Teflon systems for those cases. Also, you need to, when you're preparing samples, you need to take care that you are not using a glass pipette, because then of course you will get corrosion in your pipette. And also the volumetric flasks, they will need to be plastic. So if you're working with HF, only plastic should be used when talking about the labware or glassware. And use only when necessary, because HF is very, very toxic, and take very special care. If someone is using HF in our laboratories, we have a specific induction for that purpose. So not everyone is allowed to use HF, and not without proper introduction into this handling issue, because it's very poisonous. Then sulfuric acid. This is quite common used in dissolution of solid samples. So you might require sulfuric acid if you're not able to dissolve your sample in nitric acid or hydrochloric acid. But this affects the sample introduction system. And I will talk more about the sample introduction system next week. But here you only need to know that the sulfuric acid, if you have ever pipetted it, it's very viscous and sticky. So it also is sticky in the sample introduction system, so it affects that. Usually we like to keep it 0.5 more sulfuric acid already affects the system, but if we're working below that, then we are getting lower or smaller effects in the sample introduction system. So we try to keep it in low concentration. This is suitable for almost all elements except for the ones mentioned here, but because it's viscous and affects the sample introduction system, we tend not to use it in most cases. Also, sulfur will cause you spectral interferences in the analysis, or could cause you, and I will talk more about those a little bit later on in the lecture. Yeah, those are the ones. And then your job, maybe someone gets an idea that, okay, I will analyze a basic solution. So you have maybe some kind of, you're doing some kind of treatment or some kind of experiment where you have, let's say, sodium hydroxide in your sample. So you have pH, very high pH, and you're thinking about, okay, can I analyze? No, you need to add acid to get it into at least neutral, or preferably into an acidic pH, so you are not causing any precipitates in the system. So if you have basic samples, add acid to get the samples into acidic conditions. This is how we are avoiding to get any blockage in the system. So the sample introduction has very small tubings and small orifices, so they get blocked if we put in basic solutions. So always work in the acidic media or water at pH 7. That's, you can do it. But we like to work in the acidic region. Okay, then for element-specific guidelines, I really like this. This is Inorganic Ventures website. They have a periodic table. This Inorganic Ventures is a company who sells the stock solutions. So they know really well how these elements behave in solution media and how to prepare solutions. And this is what I usually do if I have a request that, okay, you need to analyze these elements. If I'm not sure about how stable they are or what kind of media they would like to be in, I check it from here. So they have this periodic table here. It's an interactive periodic table. So you can click on any element that you would like to see the stability or information for. So here I have clicked on aluminium, and I can see the information for this element. So it tells atomic weight, some information about chemical information here, and then about the storage and handling. How to handle, this is not very, this applies for all elements. Actually, keep tightly sealed when not in use, store unused at 20 degrees. Do not pipette from container. Do not return portions removed for pipetting to container. Chemical stability, this is soluble in HCl, nitric acid, HF, and sulfuric acid, avoid neutral media. So you will get some chemical compatibility information here. Then about the stability, this is quite important for us. So 2 to 100 ppb levels stable for months in 1% nitric acid in LDPE container. So this is a plastic container. And the ppb means micrograms per liter. It's the same thing. So if we are working at low concentration level, we will still be stable for months in 1% nitric. So it's a nice element, I would say. Then if you have more than 1 ppm solution, this is chemically stable for years if you have 2 to 5% nitric acid. So if you increase the percentage of nitric acid, you will be able to keep higher concentrations stable for years. These lower levels, it usually says that they are stable for months. So if you're working with low elemental concentrations, try to analyze them within months of when you have prepared those. Then if we're working in the even lower, so this is ppb, microgram per liter. If we're working even at lower concentrations, we would like to analyze them basically straight away or like within days. So ppb, what is the lower? What is lower than ppb? So it's nanograms per liter, but what's the abbreviation? PBQ? Do you know? Yeah, PPT. Yeah, that's right. So I will actually write those down. So this gave me a little bit of a headache when I started because no one told me these. So ppm is milligrams per liter, ppb is micrograms. Alicia, how do I put it? No. PPT is nanograms. These are very commonly used because, yeah, it's easier, I think, to say ppm than microgram per liter. Yeah. And then if you have a solid sample containing aluminium, this will also tell about the solid sample preparation. So if you have metallic aluminium, it's best dissolved in hydrochloric acid and nitric acid, I think a mixture of these.
Yeah.
And then different oxides here mentioned, they might need some kind of fusion. Fusion here, and this is soluble in acids. Yeah. But you can get lots of nice information. And this also contains atomic spectroscopy information for ICP-OS. So two wavelengths are mentioned here, or three actually, yeah, three wavelengths, and their estimated detection limits. So they are telling about the sensitivity for this element. Some interferences maybe, which could be present for these wavelengths, and RCPMS, the best isotope, I guess. So 27 mass units is the preferred isotope for ICP-MS. Yeah, PPT. Here we can actually see that. Unit. So this is, I hate this microgram per milliliter. Damn, I hate those. It makes it even more difficult to put it in my milliliters. Then you have to, okay, micrograms per milliliter. So is this BPN? I guess so.
Yes.
Yeah. Drives me crazy. And here we have the PPT. Yeah. It would be nice if someone decided, okay, use these units, please. And then we have possible interferences here. So for the three wavelengths mentioned, which are the possible interferences, and in red, this indicates that this is severe interferences. So this might not be very difficult interferences if they are in black text, but yeah. And for ICP-MS, lots more actually. There were interferences possible. Yeah. Okay, but this one you can use. So if you are deciding on how to prepare calibration standards or thinking about what kind of sample matrix to use for your samples, check the analyte here, and if even you have some solid sample, you could check the sample dissolution information here, some kind of tricks if you find something useful. Yeah. I just hope that this doesn't they don't take this away because I've been using it for several years. I've been thinking that I would need to like click on every one of them and print them into some kind of PDFs, so I would have the information if they stop the website or something like that. This is very useful. Okay, let's take a look. Okay, then we actually talked about these limits of detection and quantification last time, but let's see how they are actually determined. And this is there are different definitions to these, and practices vary how to determine these, but I will show you a couple of these here. And many people actually use US Environmental Protection Agency recommendations, and I will also tell you about those. Then some laboratories have their own internal practices also, so they have decided in their own laboratory, okay, we will define this as we want. And that's okay also. So as long as you have some reasonable backing to your decision, that's okay. Detection of limits, limit of detection. So this is the smallest concentrations that can be detected by an instrument that is significantly different from the zero or from the blank sample. Sorry, this is just, I think, translation issue. I forgot them to correct this. So different from the blank, I would say, not from the zero. But this is not reproducible or reliable result. So below the limit of detection, we cannot say those concentrations. We can't report them with reliability. Then we have a US Environmental Protection Agency two methods which cover this issue, how to determine this detection limit. And they say that blank sample, so this is just a blank. So maybe a calibration blank, a little bit of nitric acid or something, acid background there. This is analyzed 10 times after your calibration, and the detection limit is calculated as 3 times the standard deviation of these blank sample analyses. So this is pretty straightforward. So you have your method and you analyze your blank 10 times, and then calculate the standard deviation in Excel and then multiply by 3. So that's your limit of detection. Of course, you need to think about, okay, is this realistic? But in most cases, this works. Then the quantification limit, this is a little bit more tricky, maybe. And this is the lowest concentration that can be determined with sufficient precision. So concentrations above this, we can report. And US EPA methods suggest that you use the lowest concentration that can be measured within 30% of the true value. And this is determined by addition of analyte to the sample background in very low concentrations. So if we take an example of here,
I don't have the
taulukolla lights on. We take an example of the detection limits. Maybe we would have 2 micrograms per liter would be our detection limit. This is calculated from the 10 replicates or the 10 measurements of the blank sample. And okay, we have detection limit of 2 micrograms per liter. Then we are thinking about what would be the quantification limit. So we can do samples where we have concentrations of, so it will be above this, of course. So maybe starting from 5, 7, 8, 10, or something like this, 15 even. We will prepare these kinds of solutions in only our like sample matrix, so we will have acid background there, something more maybe. We will analyze this and see we have a known concentrations of these of our samples, and we will analyze this and we can see that which is producing the correct result within 30%. So if we can see this can be, so if we have 10 micrograms per liter, is it 0.7 to 1 point, is it 7 to 13 would be, am I calculating correct? I'm just winging this. This is 30% interval of the correct, right? So this would be like 7 to 13 micrograms per liter. If we get for this one, we will say that the detection limit is 10. If it differentiates more than 30%, we will increase the concentration and see which will result in the maximum of 30% difference to the true value. So we can start with the lower concentration here. Okay, maybe we see even 50% deviation from the actual true value, and then we increase the concentration until we find a concentration that is within 30% of the true value.
Yeah.
Yeah, but sometimes if we want to take it easy and do it in an easy way, we can determine this similarly to the limit of detection. So we analyze the 10 blank samples and calculate this as 10 times the standard deviation from those 10 blank samples. But I have to say that in some cases, this will produce a concentration that is too low that you are not actually able to get reproducible results above that. So this is can lead to even too high limit of detection or too low limit of detection. It depends on the case. But this would actually be a really good way to check that you are really getting the actual value that you want. And keep in mind that we are actually allowing a 30% accuracy here. So if you think about our own results, which we report to the customer, the results close to the detection limit, they can vary like 30% from the true value. So keep in mind that the results near the detection limit or the quantification limit, they are not as reliable as we go into the high concentrations where we can get 10 to 5% accuracy in most cases. Okay, then a little bit about the calibration. Last time I said that the calibration is very important, so it's the backbone of quantitative analysis. So if you have a poor calibration, cannot do anything about it, it's just not worth analyzing even. So we need to have a good quality calibration to analyze the samples. And a calibration is a series of solutions with a known concentration and a blank, which are analyzed, and then we draw a straight line through them. That's basically it. And then we have, when we analyze our samples, we get some response, and then we plot the responses onto our calibration line, and then we get the concentration of the samples. So that's what we are doing. And the accuracy of the results is affected by when we are doing the calibration, the purity of the blank. This is very important. So if you have some analytes in your plank, your calibration will be affected. Although the linearity is an important thing, so we don't want to deviate from the linear range of the instrument. Calibration line fitting. So there are different lines, fittings that can be used. I will tell more in the following slides. And the calibration range is also an important thing, how to decide the correct calibration range and the conditions used, of course. So there are several points that need to be considered. And when we are talking about low concentrations close to the limit of quantification, the accuracy of the calibration is very important because there can be very significant differences in the low concentration range if we have a poor calibration. And although these ICP instruments have a wide linear range, it's not recommended to use as wide calibration range as you can, but to fit them into your sample. So you have some known information about your samples and fit the calibration range accordingly, so that the samples don't exceed the highest calibration standard, but you're not making it way too large, just in case. It's not recommended. If you choose to have a very, very, very big calibration range, it will decrease your accuracy in most cases. Yeah, if you have samples that have very low and very high concentrations, in most cases you wouldn't analyze them in the same calibration, but you can take two calibration ranges, differentiate these into two different methods, and then analyze them at a different time. Or then, with the high concentration samples, you can dilute your samples to fit into the lower calibration curve or calibration line. So I would say that if you're working, some of your concentrations will be like tens of milligrams per liter, and then you are like in the microgram per liter, some tens of micrograms per liter. It's very, so you have a thousandfold difference in the concentrations of the sample. At least in that case, you would have to divide them into two, or dilute your high concentration samples to get more accurate results. Then I have an example here about the choosing of the calibration range. This is calibration that has been done up to 1,000 micrograms per liter. If you don't consider the part on the left, it looks pretty okay here. Correlation coefficient has 4 nines, which we want to have, looking pretty okay. This is using a linear through zero fit, so the calibration line is forced through zero here. So this is a commonly used fitting. But when we analyze 0.1 microgram per liter standard, it shows us a result of 4 micrograms per liter, and we are starting to wonder why, what could be causing this. If we take a look at the left-hand side part of the calibration range, which is not visible even here, even if, but we have to zoom in to see. So actually, our calibration line is going here, but it's missing our points. Our points are actually here above the calibration line. So our points are here. And this is caused that there is some kind of maybe contamination in the lowest calibration standards, and they are not hitting the line actually. So this is quite problematic Because if you have very high or a wide calibration range, you might miss these kinds of issues happening here. And the fitting that we are using here is a linear through zero fit, and this gives the greatest weight to the highest concentration points here, calibration points. So the highest weight is on these points, and that's why we are getting a good correlation here, even though our lowest concentration standards are not even fitting that line at all. And these lowest points have little statistical significance. But if you're working here, samples would be here, you can just remove these from the calibration and you're okay. So that's what you could do in this case. But if your concentrations are in the very low end, you would need to remove this highest calibration standards here, take them out of the calibration completely, and then redo these contaminated lower calibration standards and try to work in the lower range. Yeah, in these cases, low concentrations can't be reliably determined. Then how to choose the fitting for the calibration. So that previous example was a linear through zero. This weighs the highest calibration points. And as we saw, that analysis of low concentrations cannot be performed reliably, even if there's very small bias in the calibration points, which is in most cases. Another possibility is weighted linear fitting, which gives more weight to the lowest calibration points. So this is actually quite a good, if you're analyzing low concentrations, this is a better fit. But can lead to errors if there's contamination in the lowest calibration points. But usually you don't have, unless you're working with some of those difficult elements, iron, sodium, calcium. These are a little bit tricky. They are everywhere in our hands, in the tabletops everywhere, so it's a little bit tricky to produce pure, not contaminated calibration standards for these in very low concentration. But in most cases, this is pretty okay fitting. Then we have a simple linear fitting, which counts the blank as one of the calibration points, so it's not forcing the straight line through the blank. So this is also a nice fitting for low concentrations. Okay, then I have an example here. Calibration range is 5 to 100 micrograms per liter here, and this is linear through zero fitting, so it's forcing through zero. We are not getting only 3 nines here in the correlation coefficient, so not as good as maybe we would want. What is the? We can see the analyte because it also depends on the analyte. For most elements, we can get to the 4 nines very easily, but some cases, 3 nines is acceptable. But 3 micrograms per liter solution is showing us a result of 7 micrograms per liter, so not very ideal. It's overshooting. But then when we analyze 10 micrograms per liter solution, we are getting, well, this is overshooting also, so almost 12 micrograms per liter. So it's showing us a result more than the true value of the solution. So not ideal. Then we try a weighted linear fitting here. So it gives more weight to the lower calibration standards, and it's not forcing through zero, if you can see it here. So it actually is crossing the y-axis, not in the zero, but a little bit above. And we are getting a better correlation coefficient, and our solutions, 5 micrograms per liter and 10 micrograms per liter, they are pretty much spot on. So we are getting a lot better result with this way. And there's no difference between these, except for the data is the same, but we are just changing the fitting of the equation. And as you can see here, these points are a little bit above the calibration line. So this is causing the problem that the line is forced through the zero. Simple linear, similar case here. We are getting a better correlation. The points are fitting better into the calibration curve, and we are getting quite good results also. Yeah, this is just not giving more weight to the lower concentrations, this simple linear, as this was giving more weight to this lower concentration. So when you are working in the low range of the calibration curve, you would like to perhaps use this weighted linear fitting. Okay, then about preparing multi-element calibration standards. So when we have analytes more than one, we want to put them into the same solutions, not to have like a lot of bottles in the ICP always to analyze. So we want to If we can add the elements into the same standard solutions. But we need to consider the compatibility of analytes and their backgrounds. So they should be stable in the same matrix for us to add them into the same calibration standards. And for contamination reasons, a maximum of 15 elements in solution should be considered. So if you would like to have a solution that is more than 15 elements, you would like to then use a commercial multi-element standard. So don't pipette 20 elements into the same bottle, because there is also small concentrations of other elements in these stock solutions as impurities. So the concentration of impurities will increase as you will put in more elements into the same bottle. These commercial multi-element standards, they are a little bit pricey, but they save a lot of time in the laboratory when you're working with these calibration solutions. Then usually you want to, when you have a volumetric flask, add most of the water and all of the acid initially, then maybe swirl it a little bit, and then each element individually, stirring the flask in between. So you want to have, there is water, some acid, so there is acidic solution, and then adding the elements. Of course, taking into account that you don't add the water so much, so you don't fit all of your elements into the volumetric flask. So that's also nice to consider. Because if you put in elements only, starting from the element stock solutions, and putting them on top of each other, you could maybe cause some precipitation in the calibration standard. So it's good to have the water and acid there initially. Then when you are diluting the acid, depending on the acid and how much do you have it, this often causes the solution to warm up a little bit. So you need to wait until the temperature has stabilized before you fill to mark. And you could do it that even if you're in a hurry. I have done this sometimes. When you have a running tap water, you could cool it down a little bit if it's heating up very much. In the case of nitric acid, you're not probably getting very much warming up, but sulfuric acid is very eager to warm the solution. So these volumes are in room temperature, so take care to work in the room temperature because the volume is dependent on the temperature. And then when you prepare solutions to volumetric flasks, please don't keep them there for a longer period because there is evaporation through the bottle korkki. Korkki. This korkki in English. Bottle cap. Through the cap of the bottle, there can be possible contamination from the bottle because it's glass. So I would transfer them to plastic bottles in quite soon. And of course, you're hoarding the volumetric flask if you are preparing all of your solution in volumetric flasks. You are then taking up all of the volumetric flasks for long periods if you store your solutions and samples in those. Then attention should be paid also to the material of the container when you're transferring on the from the volumetric flask to the plastic container. LDPE is good for most solutions. Yeah, but this is usually not very. If you're working in normal conditions, plastic bottles are okay, but some elements require a little bit more attention. Then if you store your solutions for a longer period of time, you should test the stability. So if you are analyzing your calibration from your storing it for several months or half a year or 1 year even, you should check it if it has been prepared previously for and it has been standing for a longer period of time. So take some kind of other sample or other calibration solution which you check it against so you can see if there is some problems with the storage of the solution. Some elements are photosensitive. Silver, for instance, maybe need to have storage temperature in lower temperature, so put it in the refrigerator or something like this. So these are need to be considered. Then practical issues. Okay, this is maybe not do it. This is something you need to avoid, but these are things that we need to always keep in mind, tell every student, tell everyone who is working in the analytical laboratory. Some of these can you might think, well, who does it? But okay, every one of these has been done by one or two students or staff members or like this. So this is just a reminder. When you have the stock solution bottle. So they are the calibration standard stock solutions where you prepare your own calibration standards from. So you have maybe 1,000 ppm or milligram per liter of aluminium, for instance. Never put your solution transfer device or pipette in the stock solution bottle. So always when you have the stock solution, never pipette from the stock solution bottle because you're contaminating it when you're pipetting straight from the bottle. So never do it. Pour a required amount of the stock solution into a suitable container. So if you have a beaker, some kind of plastic tube, pour the amount that you need. So if you require 20 milliliters, they usually have some kind of volume measurement in those tubes, or if you're using a beaker. So not like if you need 20, don't put in 100 milliliters because that will produce waste. And if you have excess solution, never pour it back into the stock solution bottle because that will, of course, also contaminate your bottle, stock solution bottle. So the stock solution bottle is used by various people, many people for different purposes. So it's stored for even years. So if one person comes in private straits and there is something contaminating the bottle, then it's gone. So it's causing lots of problems for people who are using it afterwards. If you're performing volume dilutions, do them in room temperature because the density varies according to the temperature. So if you have a pool, or your solution is, I'm not certain in which way it works. I'm not going to mention it because I might take wrong. But work in room temperature. So if you had your samples in refrigerator, let them stabilize into room temperature before doing any volume adjustments. Do not use glass utensils with HF. I already mentioned this. So a plastic pipettes, plastic volumetric flask, plastic beakers, or HF. If you're using a micropipette, you can start by pipetting ultra pure water on the balance to check that the micropipette is in good condition. So if you have you're preparing a 1 milliliter volume, you can check what it weighs on the balance. So I usually take just a pure water, put it some kind of beaker into the analytical balance, and then pipette 1 milliliter, and it should come up as 0.9982 grams on the balance. If it's way off, you need to calibrate the micropipette. So it's worth checking. At least some laboratories do them like daily or weekly or every time they start pipetting, but it's nice to consider that your result will depend on the micropipette, on the volume that you are pipetting. So you need to pay attention here. So micropipettes are not like forever, like you can use it forever when you get it from the store, but you need to calibrate it and maintain it. And they are not like glass pipettes, those big ones, which you can use without any maintenance also, but micropipettes will require calibration and maintenance, cleaning up and things like that. Do not keep the stock solution bottle open unnecessarily because there's evaporation. Close it as soon as you have used it, and of course contamination can go in when the bottle is open. Change the stock solution often enough so there is an expiration date in the bottle, which you should follow and check that it's still valid, and make some decision when it's going bad, or if you have a very small volume at the bottom, consider if it has been there for years, consider that if it's still okay. You can even do that. You can analyze it against some fresh stock solution. So you can check it against some other solution. So that's what you can do if you want to still use it. Yeah. Then about the interferences. Do you want to have a small break? More break here? Or do we just keep on going? Are you still alive? Alive and well? Still not sleeping? Okay. Maybe we will take a look at this interferences and then I think we will be leaving a little bit earlier. So there are, I think, I would say two types of interferences in the ICP-OS technique. So there is spectral interferences and matrix interferences. And spectral interferences happen when we have a partial or a total overlap of analyte emission with a non-analyte emission. So from the ICP-OS, we are getting an emission spectrum, and then we are seeing the analyte peak. And in some cases, we have something which is not our analyte, which is on top of our analyte peak. So that's when we have a spectral interference. These can be caused by other elements in our own sample. So in that case, we cannot really avoid it. So that's present there, and we cannot help it. Sometimes we have to use some reagents in the pretreatment. If we have a solid sample, we might do some kind of fusion, which is causing us to have elements into the sample, which are then causing this spectral interference. By doing a different kind of pretreatment, we can maybe avoid these kind of spectral interferences, but in some cases, these cannot be avoided. But you need to consider that the magnitude of the interference is dependent on the analyte concentration and the interference concentration and also the sensitivity. So if you have a high concentration of your analyte, most wavelengths can be used and you won't get any interferences, even if you have a small overlap there. I will try to illustrate this a little bit. So when we are working in the low concentrations, that's the point where we usually get problems. So if we have high concentrations of our analytes, so let's say 10 milligrams per liter, let's say it's aluminium. This is our example element, I think, during this lecture. So 10 milligrams per liter aluminium. This is just, I made this up. So I don't know if the aluminium has which kind of interferences it has, but I will just make one up. So if we have iron, in the same concentration as aluminium, but it has lower sensitivity, this is direct overlap of iron. As you can see from the size of the peak is very low, this interference, the area of the interference is very small compared to the analyte area. So the concentration is calculated as the area of this peak. And I would say this area of the iron interference is quite low compared to the analyte. So this might not be even considered a major interference. But if we take the aluminium concentration lower, so the iron, because now different lines have different sensitivities. So even though I have the same concentration of these elements, these have different intensities. Are you understanding this? So the sensitivity is different for the iron. That's why we are not getting as high peak for iron, because the sensitivity is lower for iron using these wavelengths. Then when we consider a situation, I will decrease the aluminium concentration, let's say to one. One milligram per liter of aluminium. Iron is staying the same, so we have 10 milligram per liter of iron. Let's try to get. So this is the interference. The interference is staying the same, but analyte concentration is decreasing. And now you can really see that this is causing a very difficult interference in this case, because this is direct overlap, maybe 50% of the analyte concentration. So actually, in this case, I would see the 1 milligram of aluminium, and on top of that, I would actually see the iron. So my result would actually be maybe 1.5 milligrams of aluminium. And this is a significant bias, so 50% bias in this case. But the concentration and the sensitivity affects the interferences. And when we have high concentrations of analyte, we are most usually we are working in an easy situation, but lower concentrations are more tricky and the interferences are more difficult. Then we have, did I mention the partial or total overlap? I will just mention this. So this is direct overlap, this is total overlap, but then in some cases we will have like this kind of situation where there is partial overlap, where the peaks are can be differentiated, but they are partially on top of each other. So this is not so bad interference, but it's still causing errors into our analysis. Okay, what to do in these cases? If we have several wavelengths, as we usually do in the RCP always, these elements usually have quite a rich spectrum in the RCP always, so we have several wavelengths that we can choose from. Then we change the wavelength and we are happy if we find a non-interfered wavelength. If we don't find a wavelength that doesn't have any interferences, we can use higher resolution and/or peak adjustments. So higher resolution means that we are, if this is analyzed, let's say this is low resolution. Resolution helps the peaks to be differentiated from each other. So if we had high resolution, the peak is going here and it's even reaching here. We have the other peak. So this is high resolution. So if there is partial overlap and you can use a higher resolution, you can separate the peaks from each other. I actually have an example of this coming up. Then there's regression-based correction for partial overlap in the actual instrument. So in this case, if you have iron, well, it's for partial overlap only. But if you had iron interferences, you would analyze iron and aluminium as the analyte into the instrument, and then it makes a mathematical model and corrects the result. So this can be used. I've used it sometimes, but I haven't gotten results that would be so reliable that I could have used them. So in some cases, I think this could work, but that you need to consider very carefully when using these corrections that you are actually getting the actual reliable result. Inter-element correction is one of those which one you can use if you have complete overlap. And it works in a way when you have In the example, you have the aluminium and iron, iron being the interference. So you are in the inter-element correction, you are analyzing the iron using a different wavelength. So you know the intensity of iron using a different wavelength, and then you are actually subtracting the iron concentration from the aluminium concentration. So that's one option. But of course, that wavelength which you are using to analyze the concentration of the interference needs to be interference-free. So again, you might be having interferences there. But if you find an interference-free other wavelength for iron, which is the interference, you can try this, and at least our software has this automated system for the inter-element correction, which can be used. But I think in real life, people really rarely use these three or four because they are quite tedious, time-consuming. So if you have problems with the ICP always, maybe you move on to the ICP-MS, try your luck with another instrument. So very rarely people have time or the know-how to use these, because these are really little bit like requiring expertise. But this first solution, this one and two, we very often do this, or basically every time we analyze something with ICP always, we are checking that we are using a non-interfering not like an interference-free wavelength, and then we can adjust the peaks, adjust the measurement points so that we are getting a good result. I will talk more about this in later lectures. Then I have a few examples. Actually, here I already drawn the table, but this is an example of a partial overlap, and here we have green is the high resolution result here, and actually iron is our interference also in this case. As you can see, I have had a lot of iron interferences because that's always my example. And then lanthanum has been our analyte here. So this is the analytical wavelength, 379 nanometers here, and iron is a little bit higher on the wavelength spectra here. But when you're considering this pink spectra here, you cannot even tell maybe that iron is even present, because the line doesn't go down here. So you might think that the lanthanum peak, okay, my lanthanum peak is for some reason a little bit moved to the right, and you might think that this is completely the lanthanum peak. So sometimes it's worth, at least in the beginning when you're starting your analysis, building of your method, to analyze with higher resolution to see those interferences that might be present, because they might be hiding here when you are using normal resolution. Oh, forgot to translate here. Well, then another example. This is a problematic case. So I'm trying to analyze terbium. It's a lanthanide group element, and I have a really difficult time here, as you can see. So my peak is here, analyte peak, but I'm just seeing some weird background happening here. So I don't even know what's happening until I analyze with the high resolution setting, and I can see in that case is okay. I have small peaks on both sides of my analyte peak, which actually comes from the cerium, another lanthanoid element, and I have also a direct overlap with iron. And actually, I don't have any terbium in my sample. So the only intensity I'm seeing is from iron. So sometimes this is the case. And if you have a situation like this, I wouldn't use this. I wouldn't use this wavelength for anything. If you have iron or selenium in your samples, it's so difficult that you won't get a proper result. So you would need to change into a different wavelength. And how do I actually know? I have to mention that how do I know that this is iron or this is cerium and how this is iron here? So we have a spectral library in the instrument which tells us if we drag this line on top of our suspected interference here, it will show us the spectral library and we can pinpoint the elements which is causing the problems when we know our sample matrix. So I know my sample has high content of cerium and iron. I will know it's cerium and iron. So it will show a big list of the elements that are present in those wavelength regions, but from those I can select the ones that are most likely causing this interference by knowing my sample matrix. It could be that my spectral library is showing like antimony also in the same spectral area, but I know that my sample doesn't have high concentrations of antimony, so I will know it's more likely iron. Then one more interference, so matrix interference, and this is very common interference in ICP-OS as well, but it's very, we can tackle this quite easily using different techniques. So this just means that your sample background is not the same as your calibration standards, and this leads to systematic errors or bias. So ICP-OS and ICP-MS, they are relative techniques, so they depend on the calibration curve and then fitting your samples into the calibration curve. And if you are analyzing your calibration standards in a different matrix than your actual samples, you will get erroneous results. And this is because of the matrix interference. So you should always This is not okay. I was saying a different thing. Let's see what it was. Yeah, and this can lead to your analyte concentrations being lower than higher than the actual concentration. And in most cases, they are lower. And the matrix interference can be physical interference or chemical interference. And physical interference, when it occurs when sample introduction or aerosol formation are affected by the matrix of the sample. So there can be differences in viscosity, density, sample matrix. So if your samples have, let's say, sulfuric acid, the sample introduction is not working as it is without the sulfuric acid. So if your samples have sulfuric acid, you need to put it into your calibration standards also. We will talk about sample introduction and aerosol formation next week a little bit more thoroughly. Then chemical interference can occur. It affects the plasma processes. So ionization, plasma excitation properties happening inside the plasma. Then we have a special case of chemical interference, which is large amounts of easily ionized elements. So alkali metals, for instance, which change the ionic balance of the plasma. But you really don't need to consider whether it's physical interference or chemical interference or what it is. You just need to know that the sample is going, that there can be differences when there is a solution going in, if it contains acid, if it contains high amounts of sodium, iron, or some kind of other elements. There can be differences how the sample is going in and what kind of intensity response we are getting from the instrument. Caused by acids, other reagents, high concentrations of other elements. So I would say higher than 100 milligrams per liter will cause you usually some kind of matrix effect. This is very common when the sample is a pre-treated solid sample, so you will have to add some acids into your samples to get them dissolved. So you will get some high acid background. How to correct? Dilution of the sample. This is a very easy solution. So if you have high concentration of acid, just dilute until you get into a lower concentrations and you will get rid of this matrix interference. But in some cases, the analyte concentrations are so low that you cannot dilute very much. So in these cases, we have to think about something else. Matrix matching, we are always doing with ICP-OS. So this is a must. This is a must. We always do this matrix match. So we adjust the background of the calibration solutions to match the sample background as close as possible. But this will require all of the samples to have the same background. Otherwise, this will be very difficult to implement. If we have one sample sulfuric acid, one sample nitric acid, one sample hydrofluoric acid, and then we are. But in that cases, if we can dilute, we can do some kind of dilution and add then into the samples the same acid background. That's of course possible. Then internal standard is one possibility. We add the same amount of internal standards to all of our solutions. So Planck, calibration standards, samples, and so on. And the instrument does this for us. So the emission of the internal standard is used to correct all of the other emissions in the same proportion. So if our internal standard concentration, we are seeing a drop in the response of the internal standard, then the same drop is probably present for our analytes, and then we are correcting the results a little bit higher using the internal standards. This is suitable if we have varying backgrounds. So if we have different acid concentrations in different samples, we can use this internal standard. But the selection of this element, which is used for internal standard, is very essential. So we should use an element which is not present in our own samples, of course, so not to cause any differences into that internal standard. And it should behave in the same way as our own analytes. Maybe I will tell you more about this next lecture, because this will require some information which you don't yet have. But it's very common to add maybe like 1 milligram per liter of some element to all of your sample and standards, and then use that as an internal standard. What happened? Really long. Forgot to put it into the